Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I am so happy to be here. So reaching out to my audience, I want to let you know that we'll be taking your calls about health issues. But I thought it's been such a momentous month that we really needed to start off talking about the health implications and the healthcare implications of the latest wrinkle in the never-ending saga of American healthcare. And that would be the campaign promise on that Donald Trump made to repeal Obamacare. Now, that's going to be a very, very interesting nut to crack. And I thought I'd spend a little time talking about why that's not going to be terribly easy and how politically and from a business standpoint it may be, well, extraordinarily disruptive and what some of the pitfalls ahead are. So just to recap, Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, is a complex law with multiple different parts. And some of these parts, because of the rules of government, would be hard to remove. There are five things that would require a 60-vote majority in the Senate. The Republicans have 51 votes. And those five things are the parents' policies, being able to cover their kids until the kids are 26, a ban on setting rates based on health status, so redlining, if you will, based on, say, a history of cancer, limitations on age rating, and the inclusion of essential health benefits. And this includes, basically preventative care, which used to not be covered until you'd met your deductible. And what Obamacare did was it included first dollar coverage for things like your pap smear and your annual physical, and even for your flu shot and things like that. And the pre-existing condition exclusion, meaning that you can't even get insurance if you have certain pre-existing conditions. And two of those were things that Trump said he wanted to keep, the pre-existing conditions and the parents' policies until age 26. But there are things that you can get rid of very quickly. Trump could just sign a paper and get rid of coverage for contraception and cost-sharing subsidies, the subsidies for people who are lower income or mid-income that help them make those premiums. The 51 votes in the Senate could get rid of premium subsidies, the individual mandate, that means that you have to have health insurance or you pay a fine, the employer mandate, meaning that you have to have coverage for your employees, and the Medicaid expansion that went to 31 states that actually have participated in that. And if you pull back on the Medicaid expansion, you're going to throw as many as 20 million people out of insurance. So if you do, as a Republican controlled federal government, if you do everything that you could do, you're going to have a real problem as far as the insurance industry. And that's because the insurance industry would be very destabilized by removing the individual mandate. The individual mandate helps bring healthier people who debatably could just take their chances with no health insurance into the fold, and it's the money from these people that cross-subsidizes the money for the sicker people. So what happens in this scenario, if they just wipe out everything they can wipe out with a 51-vote majority, is that the insurance companies take it on the chin. They still have to insure anybody who wants to be insured, and they can't jack their rates up beyond a certain level, although one debates whether they'd be able to find a way around that one. But the number of healthy people who are currently in the insurance system, if they lost their subsidy, they would almost certainly exit. That's a large number, and that money goes away, and the insurance companies are stuck with a sicker cohort. We could anticipate that it would get much harder to get things done. and millions of people who currently have coverage would lose it. It is a extremely messy situation, and I would be very interested in any opinions or comments that any of you have about the matter. From either side of the aisle, as they say, the numbers to call are 479-1080. That's 479-1080. And I'd like to hear from you. Let's start with a story about what happens in the winter to the male libido and something you can do about it. This recent study came out of the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Siena, Italy. And they looked at the effects of a light box on sexual arousal and sexual desire in men. This was a urology clinic, and they had men who had a diagnosis of hypoactive sexual desire. And half of that group were told to use a white fluorescent light box for 30 minutes in the morning, very early, between 7 and 8 a.m. This light box produced about 10,000 lux, that's the units of lux, and they had a control group with a light box that had a neutral density filter over it that absorbed most of the radiation, so they only got 100 lux. And the light therapy, just in 2 weeks, had a fairly substantial improvement from a baseline self-rated score of 2 out of a possible 10. The bright light group had it increased to 6.3. That's almost threefold, while the control group showed no change. And these subjective measurements of satisfaction with their sexual desire were actually backed up by blood tests showing that testosterone levels almost doubled in 2 weeks, going from 2.1 nanograms per milliliter to 3.6 nanograms to milliliter. And this would have been, total testosterone based on the volumes there. They think what's happening is that bright light stimulates the pituitary gland to release luteinizing hormone. Luteinizing hormone stimulates the testicles to produce more testosterone. And they also saw a decrease in melatonin production, and melatonin, if you decrease that, you get less prolactin, and prolactin is actually an inhibitor to sexual function. So we're having at least two measurable hormonal effects that made a difference in those men. So quite interesting, and just getting up and being outside, even if it's overcast, you're going to get that 10,000 lux. So getting up between, say, 7 and 8 in the morning, putting on a jacket and sitting outside for 15 or 20 minutes might be just as good. Certainly in terms of the light dose, it would be just as good. And gents, if you are interested in maybe taking a little walk while you are absorbing those luxes, that would be even better because the exercise will do you some good. We're going to move to the first email that we have, and I wanted to get this one right out there. I was very excited to get an email from Karen in the Ivory Coast, out there in an English-speaking nodule in French East Africa, West Africa, got that backwards, and Karen writes, "Thank you for your show. High-intensity interval training is the hot thing right now, and all the literature supports it. However, I've had bad experiences, and I'd like your perspective on whether some people can actually be harmed by it or whether those like me should keep trying. The situation. Every time I've tried high-intensity interval training, I feel drained after a few sessions. Usually it's just extreme fatigue and a mild depression, which I'm prone to anyway. Recently, when I tried it, however, I began to see dull lights in my peripheral vision later in the day. I thought it might have been a diet change, lack of sleep or stress, but it seems to be worse on days that I try a workout, and better when I switch to yoga. Is it possible that I'm pushing my stress response over the edge? High-intensity interval training would be ideal because I have just a little time to spare for exercise and no equipment, but I don't want to damage anything. That's not the point. What do you think? Is this a warning sign to stop, or is high-intensity interval training good for almost everybody? Well, Karen, feeling drain means that you've pushed too hard. Without a medical history, I'd want you to take this very, very seriously. If those dull lights in the peripheral of your vision are pulsatile, then I'd want you to check your blood pressure. And I'm not quite sure what you're doing, whether you're running uphill or sprinting or lifting weights, but it sounds to me like you're having like you're overdrafting your mitochondria. And what happens when you overdraft your mitochondria is that you can't regenerate ATP quickly anymore. And it takes a couple of days for your body to get the ADP, which is able to receive that third phosphate group. And during the time that you don't have enough ADP floating around, the mitochondria are sort of, well, just like if you had an old manual transmission and you put the clutch in and gunned the engine, you're burning gas, but you're not getting any forward motion from it. And in the case of your cell's energy factories, that sort of persistent exhaustion is a sign that you've pushed too hard. So you need to stretch out the interval and maybe do a little bit less, perhaps fewer cycles of high-intensity interval training. And you want to look for that magic recovery of about 8 to 12 hours. So you can feel tired after your workout, but at 8 to 12 hours later, you should feel normal after a good night's sleep. And you may find that you can only do the high-intensity training a couple of times a week. You don't mention your age, but that can be a big factor. Also, people who have had who have any kind of overload of lead or mercury in their systems, which is fairly common. As we get older, we sort of collect this. People who have sensitivities or who are exposed to certain toxins, like food toxins or mold toxins, may have less efficient or effective mitochondria. And certainly people with chronic infections will often have problems with high-intensity interval training. I do think it is great for you, but like most things that are great for you, too much can actually cause a problem. Our next science story is about Crohn's disease, an autoimmune inflammatory disease of the colon, and maltodextrin. Now, maltodextrin is a food additive. It's a polysaccharide. It's used as a quote-unquote inert food ingredient. And artificial sweeteners like Splenda and Equal are full of it. And what it does in the intestine is very, very interesting. Maltodextrin has a profound effect on E. coli, which is an important trigger of inflammation in Crohn's disease, and is not something that we really want to be encouraging in the small intestine. When E. coli is exposed to maltodextrin, it changes and forms a very sticky, gooey biofilm. This biofilm allows the E. coli to colonize the small intestine, which ultimately could lead to small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, or SIBO, which is an important cause of irritable bowel syndrome. Many processed and packaged foods contain maltodextrin, and if you were to go to your cupboard right now and start looking at the crackers and the instant soups and the instant gravies, you'd undoubtedly find in those packaged foods, most packaged spice mixes, in fact, contain it, you would find this maltodextrin. So it's really important for us to start thinking about our microbiome like a garden and wanting to not do stuff that encourages the growth of weeds or the growth of bacteria in the wrong place. A diet that is low in processed and manufactured foods just as a rule of thumb, is going to create a more healthy microbiome. And as we go through this program, we'll be talking about some other important aspects of the microbiome. Another study related to this, the Crohn's and Colitis Foundation funded some medical cannabis research, and they looked at actual marijuana cigarettes, and this was THC, so the dose was about 11 milligrams of THC, and they gave people with Crohn's disease a couple of marijuana cigarettes a day and told them to smoke them. At the end of 8 weeks, 45% of the people in the THC group had obtained a complete remission of their Crohn's disease, and only that's 10% of the placebo group. So that's a very statistically significant result. 90% of the THC groups had improvements, but a clinical response, but not a full remission. So this is a pretty, pretty substantial effect. And this follows an older trial done in 2011, where 30 Crohn's patients out of 30, 21 had significant improvement and were able to cut back on their steroids, their expensive anti-tumor necrosis factor agents, and some of their other drugs. So a really, really important and substantial improvement. And we're going to go to our first caller now, and that is Morgan in Salinas. Hello, Morgan. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I am a very healthy 65-year-old. I've hardly been to doctors very much. I've had a lot of surgeries, like orthopedic surgeries and sports-related type of thing. But I had some lab work done recently, and my blood sugar is always perfect, like it's like 95, but then my A1C is always, like the cutoff limit is 5.7, like it's 4 point something to 5.7, and I'm always at 5.8.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what I should do about that, or if you can change the A1C.
You definitely can change the A1C. So let's talk a little bit about what's probably going on in your case is that you are getting elevated blood sugars after meals. And overnight, your liver is doing what it's supposed to be doing. It's basically making some sugar. I would view 95 as a little, it's quote-unquote normal, as in average, but it's not ideal. A blood sugar in the 80s is, or even below 80, it indicates a person who is fully insulin sensitive, and a level of 95 indicates a little bit of insulin resistance. And probably after a big meal, you might be one of those people who eats most of their calories at dinner, you know, so you have one meal. Hello?
Yes, that's true.
Yeah, so...
That is true.
Yeah, so I think what's happening is that you need to break that up, because when you eat that one big meal, you're giving your body too big a load of glucose, and it can't process it. So that glucose circulates in your bloodstream at a higher concentration, and some of the glucose molecules actually jump onto the hemoglobin, just like barnacles jump onto a boat. And so we can count those barnacles, those sugar barnacles, and that's what the A1C really is. So you're getting too high a blood sugar, but you're not seeing it in the fasting blood sugar. So breaking up your meals, simply eating half as much at dinner, and then wrap that up and bring it in the following day and have it at noon. Try to eat some breakfast too, if you possibly can, even if it's just a, you know, an unsweetened yogurt drink in the car. And look at backing down on the amount of sugar and starch in your diet. So those are the keys. But you are starting to show the disease of our culture, and the disease of our culture is diabetes. And we get it because we have an abundance of very energy-rich foods that are surpassing what our bodies were evolved to handle. And the only way around that is for you to change your behaviors, either in terms of the content of your diet, which I don't know what that is, but when I said reducing sugar and reducing starch, I almost saw the eye roll.
Yeah, because I'm a vegetarian and have been for many, many years, so I guess, you know, protein is not the main part of my diet, and I also do eat all of my food in the evenings, and I don't eat very much during the day because it's important to me to take in only so many calories because I want to be thin.
Well, so, what you need to do is switch to more vegetables, actual vegetables, and less grains. And you can, okay, and more legumes, more nuts, because particularly nuts as a protein source do not contain much in the way of available carbohydrate. So,
can I just have a few nuts at lunch and just some whole wheat toast or something for breakfast? Because I don't really want to have a big breakfast and a big lunch. I want to save all my calories for the evening because even if I eat a big breakfast and a big lunch, I still want to eat that much at night. So I just did not take in more than 1,500 calories a day. I pretty much save it all for my bad habits.
Yeah, but you asked me how you can get your A1C down. And so what you're currently doing is driving your current situation.
Okay.
So I just think you have to try some of the things that I've mentioned. Night, why don't you start off with a big salad or a big bowl of vegetable soup, right?
Okay.
And then that way you'll have a lot of water and a lot of moisture and a lot of bulk in your stomach, and that'll allow you to be more satiated. So you'll still get that nice, you know, nice full feeling, but
that's
you'll...
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Thank you. I would do that.
All right. Try that, and I'll be here. If you have more questions next month, you can call in.
Okay, thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
I have this email from Diana in Monterey, and Diana writes about Cologuard. I look forward to your podcast after every show and wanted to pass along my experience with Cologuard, a topic from one of your more recent podcasts. I didn't want a colonoscopy. I have no obvious risk factors, and I prefer an annual FIT. However, my new MD insisted on Cologuard since I refused colonoscopy. The results were positive, which led to the colonoscopy, which was negative. Needless anxiety for a test, which turned out to have a high false positive rate. This is something I would have wanted to avoid, but I didn't know that Cologuard had a high false positive rate prior to the test. So Diana goes on to write, the incidence of colon cancer detected by colonoscopy is 1 out of 100. When 100 people are given the Cologuard test, there'll be 14 positives, the one with cancer, and 13 others who are false positive. When the 14 undergo colonoscopy, 93% will be negative. When my husband discussed this test with his, different than my physician, the doctor says he doesn't order the Cologuard due to the high false positive rate. I wish I'd known it before I accepted this test. I'll never use another Cologuard again. Well, Diana, this brings up the interesting issue of how do you dial in a threshold on a test? False positive and false negative are really important concepts. So if I want to screen for a disease, I, by definition, want to find every case of that disease I possibly can. And depending on how I'm screening, I'm going to pull in people who don't have the disease, but whose results cross the threshold that we've set so that we don't miss any cases. And so in the case of this Cologuard test, the liability and just the moral imperative with any test is accuracy in diagnosing the disease. We are, after all, trying to find colon cancer in its early stages. So I think the 14% or the 13% false positive rate is less than desirable, but if we had false negatives where we said the test missed a case of colon cancer, that would be much worse. Ultimately, colonoscopy, although it is the gold standard, is not itself a perfect test. And depending upon in whose hands it is, colonoscopy may itself have a false negative result. rate of several percentage points. And I've seen everything from 5% to 15% cited in the medical literature, because colonoscopy is very dependent on the skill of the person doing it and the anatomy of the individual. Some people have very long, floppy colons, and it's really difficult to know what's going on there. So I hope that's helpful, and thank you for sharing that experience. We're going to go to our next caller. This is Jerry in Marina. Hello, Jerry. You're on the air.
How you doing? I just had a quick question. I've been taking krill oil to increase my good cholesterol, but it's kind of been giving me like indigestion.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering what you can do to supplement that. I know fish oil is one source, but is there any other sources?
Well, when you're taking krill oil, what you're taking is a large amount of DHA primarily, and that's a omega-3 fatty acid. Fish oil from cod liver oil, those are also high in DHA, but they have another one called EPA, and both of these help lower cholesterol, so that is a good strategy. The fish that have the highest levels of fish oil are salmon and sardines and mackerel. So if you can find a way to love sardines or love mackerel and eat maybe one serving a day, you could pretty much replace the fish oil supplements with just fish. The sardines obviously are fairly inexpensive. Cod liver oil is probably the cheapest source of omega-3 fatty acids, and so that's something else to look at. You can use flaxseed to get omega-3s. That's a good vegetarian source of them. But the problem with flaxseed is the amount that you have to take is literally, you know, a quarter to a half a cup a day of flaxseed. That's kind of difficult to manage unless you turn it into a nut butter or something. But you can get fairly high doses, and that may be, in fact, the least expensive source. Does that help?
Somewhat. Is there any other type of supplement that I could take besides eating fish or the flaxseed?
Your goal is to lower your cholesterol. Is that correct?
My doctor told me to take it so I could start increasing my good cholesterol, because the medication I'm taking right now kind of is inhibiting both, so my good cholesterol is kind of low.
Well, what about exercise? Are you exercising?
Yes.
Good. Exercise will increase your good cholesterol, so I'm glad to hear you're doing that. There is niacin, and you can increase your good cholesterol using niacin. The problem with niacin is it causes flushing, and the no-flush niacin doesn't work nearly as well as the regular immediate release niacin. But that is something you could look into.
Yeah, I've done that one, and the flushing was pretty bad on me. I had a bad reaction with it.
Well, other things that can be helpful are fiber. And so oat bran is the best fiber, soluble fibers in general. So maybe a teaspoon to a tablespoon of oat bran a day might also be helpful. And there's a sugar alcohol that doesn't work in everybody. It's called polycosanol. I'll spell that. P-O-L-I-C-O-S-A-N-O-L. And polycosanol, about 100 milligrams twice a day, I would say a third of the time is a great shift in cholesterol, but you just never know. You have to try it and see whether you get the result in the particular patient. But if you're a responder, it's excellent and very affordable.
Okay. All right, thank you.
You're very welcome. Thanks for the call. And I thought I would fulfill that promise that I made to tell you a little bit about the microbiome, something you might not know. I think we all know we've got bacteria in there by now. But a recent paper that came out of Cornell University was really interesting. These researchers looked at poop specimens, and they were able to diagnose in a blinded challenge all but about 15% of the samples that they were given from people with chronic fatigue syndrome. So they had an 83% success rate of diagnosing chronic fatigue just from looking at the stool samples. They had 48 people with chronic fatigue that were part of a chronic fatigue clinic, and they had 39 healthy controls. When they looked at the microbial DNA, they were able to identify several species of bacteria, and they also found that the variety of bacteria was substantially lower in patients with chronic fatigue. Now, bacteria in the bloodstream could trigger an immune response, and there's something called a lipopolysaccharide, which is a compound found in the cell wall of bacteria. If you have a permeable gut, if you have a quote-unquote leaky gut, then those lipopolysaccharides will actually diffuse across into the bloodstream, where they may be provoking the excessive immune response that is the hallmark of chronic fatigue. So everything ultimately may turn out to be tied to the gut one way or another. And in fact, recent research, I don't have the paper right here, but maybe I'll bring it to you next month. Recent research shows that if you can change the flora, you can create a remission in treatment-resistant depression in a cohort. So getting rid of those processed foods, eating a diet rich in vegetable material and fiber, this can make a big difference for apparently just about everything gets a bit better when you do that. So as we move through the holiday season and all of that abundance, keep in mind, eat your veggies, even if you put cheese sauce on them. At least eat the veggies. Looks like we've got a call here right now. So we're going to Andres in Watsonville. Hello there. You are on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just wondering, so recently I quit drinking coffee and I started drinking a lot of kombucha, and I was wondering what your thoughts are on kombucha and probiotic drinks in general.
Okay, so are we talking about grow your own kombucha that's got a really kind of strong smoky bitter taste? Are we talking about the commercial kombucha drinks that are often sweetened with sugar or cane syrup?
Why not both?
Well, okay, let's start with the commercial ones. I don't think they're nearly as good for you as the homegrown variety. And that has to do with the fact that they put things in, like sugar, to improve the taste. And they have certain flavorings added. But it's mostly the sugar that I'm disliking. When you have your own kombucha, you've burnt up most of the sugar in the process of making the kombucha, so it doesn't really taste very sweet. And a lot of these are bacterial and fungal fermentation products. I mean, the way this stuff was discovered was basically, I don't know if you've ever had a teapot that you forgot about that was maybe half full, and then it got moldy. Well, imagine that you didn't notice the mold and you drank the tea. That is effectively kombucha, except that the optimized colonies have been figured out and distributed. And so it's the ultimate fermented food, and it contains a lot of chemical compounds that are profound antioxidants and also really improve the functioning of the liver. So, yes, it is possible to overdose on it. And, you know, you want to be reasonable in somewhere in the 8 to 16 ounces a day category and not be drinking liters of the stuff. Because if you overdose on it, you actually can give yourself hepatitis, an inflammatory chemical hepatitis, I want to add, not an infectious hepatitis. So I don't, and that's rare. It takes an awful lot of kombucha. But it seems like somebody is always managing to overdo. You know, a little bit is good, so more must be better. Not necessarily so.
Wow. Well, thank you.
You're welcome. It was an interesting question. Thanks for calling in.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And let's talk a little bit about an unintended consequence of a very common drug, metformin. Now, metformin is one of the more commonly used drugs for diabetes, and it is often now used for pre-diabetes here in the United States, and I presume elsewhere as well. It has some benefits in that it helps you lose weight. There's certainly nothing wrong with that. A recent study coming out of Canada showed that metformin treatment had a profound effect on mortality from prostate cancer. And this was a retrospective study looking at metformin in prostate cancer patients. And what they found was that for every 6 months that patients were on metformin following their diagnosis for prostate cancer, they had a substantial improvement in survival, a 24% drop in mortality. Now, we are not sure the mechanism here, and it's not clear whether this would work in a non-diabetic, but it's an extremely intriguing question. What metformin, in the light of this, is now being tested in brain, breast, lung, uterine, colorectal, pancreatic, skin, blood, and thyroid cancers. We think at a minimum that by decreasing insulin levels, it is somehow disadvantaging the cancer cells, possibly directly interfering with their physiology, or possibly because it lowers blood sugar, and cancers in general need sugar to survive. They don't do well on fat or protein, and this is why some people actually use a high-fat diet in cancer treatment, and that's being studied now. Some of the preliminary findings for this ketogenic diet look promising, but I don't think it's quite ready for prime time. Although in my practice, when I'm working with cancer patients, I will try very hard to get them to reduce the sugar and reduce the grain, eat a high vegetable diet. There's lots of data that enforce that that both helps you deal with cancer therapy and also improves your survival. Again, we're still working on understanding the mechanism. But metformin comes at a price, and I wanted to be sure I put this out there because I know many people who are listening to this program are taking it. Metformin reduces B12, and B12 is extremely important. Diabetics are at increased risk for neuropathy, damage to their nerves. And when you have low B12, you are much more vulnerable, and your nerves are much more vulnerable. So if you take metformin for about 4 years, let's suppose you had what we call this is the number needed to harm. So if 14 people take metformin, one of those for 4 years, one of those persons will suffer neuropathy as a result. And there are over 100 million prescriptions of metformin given every year. And yet most doctors don't know to tell their patients that if they're taking metformin, they must also be taking B vitamins. I'm a great fan of multivitamins, but if you're a diabetic, you should be on a B complex, getting at least 100 micrograms of B12 daily. And if you take a proton pump inhibitor like omeprazole or Prilosec because you have heartburn, which is very common in this population, then you've got a twofer, two things that are lowering your B12, and you should be monitoring the B12 levels at least annually with your physician to make sure that you're not deficient, because it is a really important prevention or precaution for developing difficulties with neuropathy. And once you get that neuropathy, it's painful and very, very difficult to treat. Let's go to another email. This one from Gary in Hilo, Hawaii. I have severe osteoporosis and want to maintain optimal bone health. My vitamin D level is 55, and I'm taking calcium citrate. He says 950 milligrams for a day and 200 milligrams of cholecalciferol vitamin D per day. And I'm hoping to start either Prolia or Forteo if I can get the VA to pay for it. So Prolia is a monoclonal antibody that attacks rankle and helps prevent bone breakdown. And Forteo is actually a parathyroid hormone analog, which logically you would think would cause the calcium to come out of the bones. But it turns out when you give it as a shot at a long interval, like a weekly interval, you actually do the opposite and you turn off responsiveness to parathyroid hormone and therefore reduce the amount of calcium that comes out of the bones. Both of these agents are second-line therapies, and people generally have to fail a bisphosphonate before any insurance, including the VA insurance, is going to let them have it. So Gary goes on to say that he lifts weights, and he wants to know if he takes a combo of apple cider vinegar, baking soda, ginger rhizome, honey lemon, and fresh garlic. Will that address his bad LDL cholesterol? And he's got a 172. So, Gary, my advice on that is I'm all for apple cider vinegar. I think it does some good things. I don't like to mix it with baking soda because that interferes with some of the benefit of the apple cider vinegar. So you're better off taking your baking soda separately. And small amounts of honey because you don't want to have, glucose, sugar, raises your insulin level. Insulin is going to actually increase your cholesterol. So one thing you'd want to do is to make sure that you're reducing sugar and grain in your diet and maybe think about going to my favorite thing, and that's that fish oil, which I really feel should be considered a vitamin. I think we all would do a lot better if we ate fatty fish a couple of times a week, just on general principle. One last story, I think. This one really caught my heart. This is a group called the Warrior Canine Connection. And what they do is they use veterans who have PTSD and traumatic brain injury, and they use them as volunteers to train service dogs for other soldiers who have spinal cord injuries. It's a nonprofit, and they have offices at multiple places, including Palo Alto Veterans Administrative Healthcare System. The idea is positive methods of shaping behavior, teaching the veterans with post-traumatic stress disorder to train dogs. So mastering the skills and patience required to train a service dog, but also what you have to train the dog to do, gives these PTSD veterans insight into how to regain control of their own emotions, harnessing the training to help them focus their intention, improve their social competence and their sense of well-being. And it's lovely because it helps other disabled veterans, giving them a well-trained service dog free of charge. And the trainers have the incredible experience of being able to give a gift to other veterans, which enlarges for them their sense of personal significance. Trainers teach the dogs that the world is a safe place, and in teaching the dogs that, they find that they are able to interact more effectively with their own children, and that they are able to interact and control their inner child, and it has been a very big benefit. And I just thought that was a kind of beautiful Christmas story to share with you here as we move into this holiday season, a time of giving and a time of reaching out to family and friends. So speaking of reaching out to family and friends. I just want to give everyone a big hand and wish you all a happy holiday season.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.